it as the most outstanding member of the faculty. I feel the tick-tocks of my clock pressing me to accomplish what I can do within my remaining time in life, he says. On weekends, he and Dan Moore blow off steam by riding their motorcycles together up Highway 49 through the Sierra foothills. Mei Ying Zhang, who now uses her married name, Mei Ying Li, lives in Sacramento. In 1988, when we met for the first time at the Bangkok restaurant in downtown Merced and talked about everything from the democratic process to the cultural attitudes of Hmong teenagers to her late father's admonition that his children must never spit on American sidewalks, I had a suspicion that she wouldn't stay a clerk typist for long. Mei Ying ended up earning a bachelor's and a master's degree by studying nights and weekends while working full-time and raising four children. I saw her grow into a local and national Hmong leader during her years as the executive director of the Hmong Women's Heritage Association, an organization that provides social and health services to Hmong families. She is now a consultant there, as well as the lead trainer for Connecting Worlds, its interpreter training program. In 2001, she won the National Hmong Women's Leadership Award, given annually to the person who has accomplished the most to advance the status of Hmong women and girls. In 2005, she received a Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Community Health Leader Award, along with the grant to her organization of more than $100,000 for having overcome incredible odds to improve local health care. At 18, Mei Ying had been second runner-up to Miss Hmong. At 18, her daughter Mercedes one-upped her by becoming Miss Hmong International in a pageant that, according to its organizers, was inspired by a folktale called Dong Na and Gong Chuo, about a man who seeks the most beautiful woman in the entire universe. All of Leah's doctors have left Merced. None of them have grown rich. None have forgotten that they went into family practice or pediatrics because they wished to serve the underserved. Bill Selvage works in a small rural clinic in North Carolina. After spending 15 years as its lead physician, he says he is now just a staff family doc taking care of an increasingly geriatric population as my patients age along with me. Dan Murphy is the director of a clinic in a blue-collar town in Central Oregon where, because he's in charge, can allow himself the luxury of spending at least half an hour with each of his patients instead of the 15 minutes he had at MCMC. So he has plenty of time, as he says, to ask how things are going and to make sure they're up to date on their mammogram and their colonoscopy, even if they've come in with a banged thumbnail. He has become an impassioned advocate of an approach called patient and family-centered care, in which patients and their families are formally incorporated into every step of their medical treatment by being asked what they want, which Dan says is often very different from what we think they want, and consulted on matters from medication administration to lobby design. He believes his philosophy leads to reduced medical errors, better outcomes, lower costs, fewer miserable patients, and more doctors who know how to listen. After several years of visiting Dan in Oregon and envying his life both inside and outside the clinic, Neil Ernst and Peggy Philp moved north to join his practice. They are both still committed, as Neil puts it, to getting good and sweaty nearly every day by running, biking, hiking, playing tennis, or swimming. Neil has clocked more than respectable times for his age group in many road races. Of course, athletic competition is nothing new for him. The last time I saw Neil, he casually mentioned something he'd never revealed in all of my years of interviews for this book, that he'd once pitched a no-hitter for UC Berkeley. Their elder son, Toby, who had leukemia as a boy, works for Nike and celebrated his 20th year of remission by competing in a triathlon. Neil and Peggy still frequently think and talk about Leah. We probably would make the same decisions now if we had the resources that we had then, before better meds and better interpreters, he says. But as pediatricians, at the end of our careers instead of at the beginning, we might push a little less on the family. In the end, we think the results would have been the same. The hospital where Neil and Peggy practiced pediatrics for 22 years and from which Nikau once abducted his daughter after he believed he was being forced to sign a piece of paper that she was going to die in 2 hours, has improbably become a hotbed of cross-cultural innovation, the subject of articles in the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, and a model for programs across the country. In 2009, MCMC, which had morphed into Sutter Merced Medical Center and then into Mercy Medical Center Merced, instituted the country's first formal shaman policy, a systematic plan to integrate Zinengs into patient care. Healthy House, a storefront social service agency in downtown Merced that works with the hospital to help Hmong and other minority patients feel less marginalized, launched a training program called Partners in Healing, in which local Zinengs spend 40 hours touring operating rooms, looking through microscopes, learning about blood tests, and in general, being exposed to the aspects of medical treatment that once seemed most mysterious to Hmong patients. Graduates of the program are given laminated badges that grant them access to patients' rooms, much like other clergymen. Mercy Medical Center's policy, PC-369, specifies 9 ceremonies that may be performed at patients' bedsides. 4 chants to alleviate blood loss, internal injuries, burns, and unconsciousness. 3 string-tying rituals to retain the soul, strengthen the body, and prepare the patient for surgery. And 2 soul-calling rituals, one to retrieve the soul of a sick person and one to retrieve the soul after death. No animals may be killed in the hospital. Too bloody. And no gongs, rattles, or finger bells are permitted. Too noisy. At the moment, the burning of joss paper and joss sticks is prohibited, but Healthy House hopes this practice will eventually be accommodated by moving patients into a special room whose smoke alarm has been disconnected. More than 100 shamans have been trained as partners in healing. Because Zinengs enjoy such high status in the Hmong community, their endorsement of the hospital has had powerful ripple effect outside its walls. Inside, although problematic cases still crop up, they are less frequent and less catastrophic, not only because of Healthy House's efforts, but because most Hmong are now bilingual and bicultural, less likely to need interpreting, though it is skilled and available, and more likely to trust their doctors. Even many older Hmong in Merced and elsewhere have become less suspicious of conventional and medical treatment. Although Fo still grows healing herbs in her backyard, she also takes insulin for her diabetes and urges her children to see their doctors when they are ill. Mercy Medical Center's attention to cultural issues reflects a national trend. A 2007 report by the Joint Commission, the country's largest healthcare accrediting organization, found that all 60 of the hospitals it surveyed offered interpreting services, either in person or by telephone, and more than 75% address cultural needs through religious, spiritual services, dietary services, and psychosocial services. The nomenclature used to describe culturally sensitive healthcare is evolving so fast that you might miss the largest iteration if you blink. During the last few years, the term cultural competence has been criticized both for its implication that one can actually become competent in someone else's culture, as one might become competent in tennis, and for its tendency to degenerate into what Arthur Kleinman calls a series of do's and don'ts that define how to treat a patient of a given ethnic background. In other words, doctors who once paid no attention to their patients' culture and ethnicity may now be in danger of seeing them only in those terms. Cultural humility acknowledges that doctors bring the baggage of their own cultures, their own ethnic backgrounds, along with the culture of medicine, to the patient's bedside, and that these may not necessarily be superior. Cultural responsiveness encourages doctors to listen to patients and respond to them both as members of their cultures and as unstereotyped individuals. If this all sounds like a Yertle the Turtle-like scramble for the slippery pinnacle of political correctness, remember how difficult life used to be for the Hmong patients and patients from many other backgrounds before doctors started thinking about why so many cross-cultural cases ended badly. My only concern is that these terms are more likely to appeal to liberals, and conservative doctors may therefore resist them. Whatever you choose to call it, the ability to deal with patients from unfamiliar cultures shouldn't be a political stance, but a human stance, as well as a strategy that saves lives. The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down is a book written in the 1990s about the 1980s. The Lee family arrived in the United States in 1980. Leah was born in 1982 and had her neurological crisis in 1986. Although that statement sounds as if it belongs in what my daughter used to call the Department of Duh, you'd be surprised by how many people have either overlooked the dates or assumed that nothing has changed since then. Hmong American culture has not been frozen in time. By now, most Hmong families have been in the United States for more than 30 years, which means that their children have been educated here and are likely to speak English better than they speak Hmong. It drives me crazy that if I were a young Hmong American, it would drive me even crazier when someone who has read this book meets a 20-year-old named Vu or Vang or Tao and expects him to act like Nikau Lee. When the first waves of Hmong refugees came to the United States in the mid-1970s, most shared the same religion, animism, the same occupation, farmer or soldier, the same economic status, low, and the same educational history, little or none. The 260,000 Hmong who currently live in the United States, a number that in recent years has expanded not because of new arrivals, but because early marriages still lead to short generations and families are still large, are vastly more heterogeneous in every one of these categories. Some are animist. Some are Christian. Their occupations range from welfare recipient, though reliance on public assistance has dwindled, to state senator, with innumerable doctors and businessmen, and a few rappers and comedians in between. Although just over a quarter still live below the poverty line, nearly half now own their own homes. Their political clout was evident in 2008, when more than 1,800 Klan leaders and other activists showed up to harangue elected officials about the Patriot Act at a Stockton town hall meeting organized by the Hmong National Leadership Network. Less than 2 weeks later, President Bush exempted the Hmong from a provision of the act that had classified many of them as terrorists. thereby preventing them from finding employment, obtaining driver's licenses, and becoming permanent residents. Because they had engaged in an anti-governmental activity which is unlawful under the laws of the place where it is committed. That activity had consisted of fighting for the United States in Laos during the Vietnam War. Despite these changes, Hmong Americans are, in many of the most essential ways, still Hmong. Parents may be less likely to tell their children traditional folktales or teach their daughters Pan Dao. And when those children grow up, they may be less likely to live next door. But most grandparents and great-grandparents still live in their children's homes, rather than being shunted off to retirement communities and nursing homes. Mutual assistance organizations still play a cohesive role in Hmong communities. Clans are intact. Animal sacrifice is still practiced, though not by everyone, and at the most important junctures, birth, marriage, death, the traditional rituals are, if not universal, still prevalent. Dan Moore believes that the Hmong community would wither without its traditions. Take two plants, he says. One you shake all the dirt off its roots. The other, you leave the dirt. Which do you think is going to survive when you put it in a new pot? Dan may have shaken off his final G, but I have few worries about the hardiness of his roots. Because I was so angry about the disastrous mishandling of their resettlement in the United States, I used to think the Hmong would have been better off if they'd been able to stay in Laos or Thailand, or at least gone somewhere wild where they could be left alone to farm, like French Guiana. I am no longer so sure. I still believe it is possible for Phua, Nikau, and many other Hmong refugees their age to reassemble lives as emotionally rich as the ones they led in their villages in Laos before the war. Their generation was, in effect, sacrificed. But the Lee children would never choose to leave their homes in California, purchased or rented with wages earned in jobs they obtained because they were educated in American public schools and returned to the hand-hewn house in Hoi Soi in which some of them were born. The complaint I hear most often from my Hmong friends is not that they would like to leave the United States, but that they wish they encountered less persistent ignorance about who they are and why they came. Here in Merced, you might see Hmong men on the street who look like drunks, Dan Moore says. They don't dress up correctly, they don't walk nicely, but they are not drunks. They are the heroes who saved American lives and got wounded. Sometimes we lost 100 lives to rescue one downed American pilot or just get back the carcass. You cannot educate Americans overnight about this. You must do it over and over. But how do you educate Americans if they hear about the Hmong only when something goes wrong? In recent years, the word Hmong has appeared in particularly glaring headlines 3 times. The first was in 2004 when a deer hunter named Chai Sua Vang shot 8 white deer hunters in northern Wisconsin, killing 6 of them. The media rummaged for evidence that Vang had committed the murders for cultural reasons. That is, because he was Hmong. I thought this was lunatic. If you had talked to several dozen Hmong in 1988, as I did, and all of them had told you that they mistrusted American doctors, you might reasonably surmise that culture had something to do with it. But if one Hmong commits a crime that no other Hmong has ever committed, how can you possibly conclude that culture, rather than stress, an aggressive personality, mental illness, or whatever else might motivate someone to commit mass murder, is behind it. When a hunter named James Nichols shot and stabbed a Hmong hunter named Cha Vang 2 years later, also in the Wisconsin woods, no one said he did it because he was white. Hmong also made the news in 2007 when the celebrated General Vang Pao was arrested for allegedly plotting to overthrow the Lao government. The charges were dropped in 2009. He died in 2011. Americans who somehow missed the coverage of the AK-47s and Stinger missiles that Vang Pao supposedly planned to purchase, and who had also missed the coverage of the "Save a Deer, Shoot a Hmong" bumper stickers that had been sold in Wisconsin after the hunting murders, could not escape learning the word Hmong in 2008 when Clint Eastwood's film Gran Torino was released. The story of a bigoted Korean War veteran and his Hmong neighbors drew a mixed response from the Hmong American community. On one hand, there were more than 20 Hmong parts all played by Hmong actors. On the other, the film was riddled with cultural inaccuracies. Hmong grandmothers do not chew betel nuts and therefore do not expectorate brown saliva. Traditional Hmong clothes are worn by wedding couples and New Year celebrants, not funeral guests. Soul callers stand at the door, not in the middle of the living room. Unsurprisingly, the line, "the girls go to college and the boys go to jail," was not popular. One Hmong critic described the overall effect as that of an infantilized Hmong community incapable of fending for itself and severely lacking in the proper tools for success in America. My friend Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, one of my favorite nonfiction writers, once told me, "Journalism is the only occupation in which at all times you know less than anyone else in the room." That was true for me in the Lees' apartment, true in the little rented car in which I used to sit with Mei Ying late at night, parked under a street lamp on East 12th Street after we finished talking with Pho and Nakao, listening to her explain the cultural nuances that had slipped past me. True in the cubicle at Lao Family Community, in which Blia Yao Mua told me that Hmong culture was not Cartesian. True in the MCMC cafeteria, where Dan Murphy told me that Leah's case had destroyed his idealism. True even when I sat alone at my desk at home in New York, surrounded by dozens of books and articles and dissertations, in despair because I thought that I would never get done, or if I did, that what I wrote could not possibly do justice to what I had seen and heard. There were so many mistakes and so many failures. Before I met Mei Ying, I chose the wrong interpreters and wondered why most Hmong families wouldn't give me the time of day. Several months into the project, I flew from New York to Merced because I'd heard the Lees were about to hold a Ning ceremony, only to find out once I got there that it was for Pho, not for Leah. That ended well. Had I not attended Pho's ceremony, I wouldn't have known what to look for the next year when I came back for Leah's. My most spectacular failure occurred when the New Yorker editor who had assigned this project, and to my everlasting gratitude accepted it before he left the magazine, was replaced by someone whose interest in epileptic Hmong toddlers was, not to put too fine a point on it, modest. The new editor informed me that she wasn't running the piece in a letter in which she misspelled both my first and last names. That too ended well. Had the magazine piece been published, I never would have written a book. In fact, the main reason I plunged back into the project for another 5 years or so is embarrassment. If I hadn't, I would have had to tell Fua, Nikau, Neil, and Peggy that the hundreds of hours they had spent with me were wasted. I couldn't face saying that sentence, so I wrote a 300-page book instead. We do not see the world as it is. We see it as we are. So goes a saying variously ascribed to the Talmud, Immanuel Kant, and Shirley MacLaine, and equally wise no matter who said it. I constantly fought, and still fight, the assumption that my perspective was the perspective. I knew this was the trap into which both sides in Leah's conflict had fallen, but the fact that it was the central lesson of my book made it no easier to avoid. The problem is succinctly elucidated in a Jack Ziegler cartoon that hangs above my computer. A frog looks up at a cow with a surprised expression that says, "Wow, that's one big ugly frog." The cow looks down at the frog with exactly the same expression and says, "Yikes, what an incy-wincy cow." We are all frogs or cows, and we wander through life in a state of perpetual bafflement because empathy is so hard. Harder than anger. Harder than pity. I think I understand a few things better now than I did then. But that does not mean I am tempted to rewrite these pages. The spirit catches you and you fall down belongs to its time. It would be misguided to impose what historians call presentism, a hideous but apt neologism, by saying changing retarded to developmentally disabled. Even though I would not say retarded now or updating the awestruck reference to the hundreds of Hmong students who conversed on the internet relay chat system, the internet did not exist when I began this book. It was in its infancy when I finished. I did all my research without it, aside from a single session at Mei Ying's husband's computer. The result might be a good book, maybe even a better book, but it would not be this book. With a handful of exceptions, I have resisted making changes in this edition because I knew that if the older me started meddling with the work of the younger me, she'd throw the balance of the whole book out of whack. If I were starting from scratch today, I wouldn't write the book. I couldn't. Back then, it was impossible to read nearly everything that had been written about the Hmong. It took me 4 years. Now, it would take me several lifetimes. Hmong America has ramified so gloriously that I could not begin, not even think of beginning, not even dream of thinking of beginning, to pin it down. Also, although the great majority of the letters I've received from Hmong readers have been positive, most of the negative ones have criticized me for telling a story that was not mine to tell. I am no lover of identity politics. I believe that anyone should be allowed to write about anyone. Still, I would have harbored the same proprietary resentment had I been they. It was exactly how I felt 30 years ago when women's voices were harder to hear because men were drowning them out. Now that young Hmong writers are starting to publish, including My Ning Mo, who edited a landmark literary anthology called Bamboo Among the Oaks, and Cao Kalia Yang, who wrote a fierce, sad memoir called The Late Homecomer, I am happy to shut up and listen. I hope The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down is settling into its proper place not as the book about the Hmong, but as a book about communication and miscommunication across cultures. For the last 15 years, I have watched from the sidelines with unflagging interest and diminishing expertise, grateful for the amateur status that has excused me from reading each new 500-page volume of Hmong scholarship. But my friendship with the Lees, even though there have been gaps and misunderstandings along the way, has never moved to the sidelines. There was the period when True faxed me her high school essays from the Motel 6 where she worked as a night clerk. I'd make a few grammatical corrections. She needed no other help, and faxed the pages back. I hadn't forgiven the 8th grade language arts teacher who wrote on May's account of her family's escape from Laos to Thailand. "You had an exciting life. Please watch the verbs in past tense." True always faxed a letter along with the essay to keep me up to date on year's latest volleyball tournament or the hoop lee for Zua's newest daughter. There was the time that True, Yer, and their friends Ku, Tu, Nicole, and Singh visited us in Massachusetts, and one night, searching for an open supermarket at which to buy me a surprise birthday cake, drove all the way to Vermont. They found a cake. Balloons, too. There was the time I visited the Lees in California, and Fu, via Mei Ying's translation, introduced several babies who were crawling on the living room floor as nieces and nephews. I told Mei Ying that they looked too young to be Fu's nieces and nephews. "No," she said. "She thinks of you as a daughter. They're your nieces and nephews." Who knows if George would have proposed to me if Fu hadn't dressed me up as a Hmong bride? Who knows what kind of mother I would have been without Fu, who had been legally declared a child abuser, but was the best mother I had ever met. As a model, she and Nakao had so many children that their household was like a longitudinal study. If you carry your babies around all day long and pick them up whenever they cry, how will they turn out at 3, 8, 10, 12, 14, and 16? I would have assumed the result would be a family of spoiled brats. But the Lees proved me wrong. When I had children myself, I was scared to use a nye. After I slung the baby over my shoulder, what if the aerial trajectory continued? But I was glued to my snuggly, and under Fu's influence, I breastfed my kids till they were approximately in graduate school. Nikau died a few years after I lost my own parents. His funeral lasted for 3 days and 3 nights. Because it was held in an American funeral home, no animals could be killed on the premises, but a live cow with huge horns was driven to the parking lot in a trailer. One end of a long string was tied to the cow, and the other end was snaked through the back door across the main hall to the open casket and into Nakao's hand. The cow was then sacrificed elsewhere and its head brought back to the hall, along with several other cows paid for by friends and relatives. It would accompany Nakao on his posthumous journey. Because he had been such a respected member of the community, the hall was packed. There were 6 qing players and a death drum. A push of wailing mourners crowded around the casket. They cried so hard that Nakao's blue silk jacket was wet with fallen tears. My parents had both been cremated. They had asked my brother and me not to hold memorial services. My mother left strict instructions that we were not to see her body. As I stood over Nikau's casket, wiping my eyes with a paper napkin from a stack set out for the mourners' use, Kleenex would not have been strong enough for the job. I thought, not for the first time, my culture is dry. We do not know how to mourn. Our feelings catch in our throats because we fear it would be unseemly to let them out. Nikau's death would have caused me even greater sorrow were it not for the same extraordinary that had happened less than 2 months earlier. I had been asked to speak about this book at UC Davis, where Mai was a student. It occurred to me that the university might be willing to invite Mei Ying too, and Neil, and Peggy, so we could all speak together on a panel, and that Fo and Nakao might be able to attend with a good interpreter at their side. This all came to pass. Fo and Nakao heard Mai speak eloquently to an audience of more than 400. They also heard Neil's voice break when he spoke of how difficult it had been to remove Leah from her family and put her in foster care. They heard him say that although he felt he had no other choice, he was sorry for the hurt he had caused. Afterward, Nakao, looking old and ill, walked up to Neil. It was the first time I had ever seen them together, my conversations with the Lees and my conversations with their doctors had all taken place at different times and in different places. Though Fo had forgiven Neil and Peggy long ago, I had never heard Nakao say a kind word about them. But on that afternoon, he looked Neil in the eye. Something Neil never remembers him doing before, and told him, with his daughter translating, that now he understood how much Leah's doctors had cared about her, and he thanked Neil. In that moment, before we all headed to dinner, I heard what I had imagined when I wrote the preface to this book 15 years ago. A Common Language. A.F., Western Massachusetts, 2012. This has been an Audible Studios production of The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, written by Anne Fadiman, narrated by Pamela Zhang, producer Mike Charzik, copyright 1997 by Anne Fadiman. Afterward, copyright 2012 by Anne Fadiman. Production copyright 2014 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.